Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have the always wonderful, always entertaining, always insightful Stephanie Crawford joining me this evening. Hi, Steph.
Sup? That was a terrible greeting.
Nope, you did great. That was perfect. So tonight we are talking a couple movies that Steph picked for the episode, and this is kind of cool. It's an interesting combination of films that are going to hit probably different audiences, and we're hoping to maybe connect with some different people over the different movies. But we're going to start with Arrow's new massively awesome Blu-ray of Crimson Peak, and then we're going to move into the Criterion Collection release of Elaine May's film Mikey and Nikki. But yeah, let's talk about this Crimson Peak, Steph. This is a pretty epic box, I gotta say.
Ghosts are real. That much I know. I've seen them all my life.
Would you be mine? Edith, this is my sister.
I don't think she's the right choice.
You have to trust me.
Thomas, your bride is frozen.
I'll run you a hot bath.
There are parts of the house that are unsafe.
What was that?
A house as old as this one becomes, in time, a living thing.
Never go below this level.
And now Crimson Peak is a nut dog, a beautiful, strange bird. I think it was sold and marketed as a horror film because it was coming out on Halloween and all that, but it really is not. And it doesn't even, is interested even in the mechanics of horror. It's interested in this borderline fairy tale land that is gothic romance. Gothic romance was born in the 18th century, around 1764, when the first Gothic novel was born, Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole. A very, very interesting moment that is a reaction, a romantic and emotional reaction to the rigidity and inflexibility of sort of the age of reason and academia and all these ideas that enthroned reason above anything, and that rejected the older forms of narrative like fable and fairy tale and myth and lore.
Yeah, this box set is amazing, and I gotta say I was pretty floored by it. You know, how did you feel about it?
No, it's absolutely stunning. I remember when they announced it was coming out, I had the previous Blu-ray release, and even with films I'm a fan of, it's not always an automatic upgrade for me. But with this one, I saw the cover. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
I immediately took out my copy, put it in the trade-in pile for my local record store.
Nice. You have one of those? Very cool.
Yeah.
I mean, a trade-in pile. I do the piles, too. I'll make a little, okay, you're on your way out, buddy, kind of pile. Sort of thing. Yeah, it's definitely that kind of. And even looking at the picture, I was like, oh, that looks really cool. But then you get it and you hold it in your hand and it's like a fucking book, you know, in that beautiful, you know, way that ties directly into the opening of the film where the book is opened and everything. And it's just gorgeous. I mean, just the packaging is, I'm not like a packaging, you know, I don't get all crazy about packaging. I love good packaging, but you know, I'm more about movie and features and stuff. But this one, I was just like, wow, this is pretty great. In fact, I had to return one of them to Amazon because it got kind of banged up in the mail.
No.
Too much to the point where I was, well, it's not a big deal. At least Amazon is easy about that stuff. But it got banged up enough, like one of the corners was kind of split open. And I was like, okay, no, I can't. I got to be that guy on this one. This is just too nice.
Now, I remember you sending me a photo of that and you're like, I hate to do this, but this is unacceptable. I'm like, no, you're absolutely right.
You know, when it's torn open, the thing I have for my OCD collecting is I'll have initial reactions to packaging damage. And then, you know, if it's slight enough, I'll usually be like, okay, that's going to be fine. Once I put that on a shelf, I'm never going to have to look at that again. It's going to live on the shelf. It's not that big a deal. But that initial OCD is like, it needs to be perfect because it's brand new and I didn't mess it up myself yet. And I probably will damage it myself at some point. And I'd rather have the damage be mine. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
What are you doing to your Blu-rays that you're like, well, of course, I'll eventually damage it. There's no question about that, but not you, you know, corporation.
Yeah, me only. You know, I throw them on the floor. I roll around on them, you know, that kind of stuff. Okay. Everybody does that, you know.
Okay, like, hey, doggy, you want a toy?
No, dogs.
No, there's Arrow always does an amazing job with their limited editions. They're in those really thick cases. The booklet is always really well done. The artwork's always great. But this is a step beyond.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because, well, Del Toro is a very visual director, and he himself referred to Crimson Peak as his most beautiful film. And upon rewatching it, I think I agree with him.
I do too.
And it's probably hard to watch that and be like, you know, maybe we should do something extra. You know, we have a lot to live up to aesthetically here.
Yeah. No, and they've really outdone themselves. I mean, this is, I'm not to get too far ahead of what we're talking about, but this is like kind of on the level of the Night of the Demon box from Indicator. It's like that kind of a release, that level, you know, if you're thinking about it. I mean, we'll get into it as far as everything, but it's pretty fucking great, I gotta say. So is this one of your favorites? Where does this lie in his filmography for you? How do you feel about it with in relation to the others? I mean, you said most beautiful, but...
Yeah. Oh, that's a question. You put me on the spot. So full disclosure, I am a complete Guillermo del Toro fangirl.
Nice. Me too.
I have been for years. He's one of the few directors where I don't actually need to hear about the project. Of course, I want to hear about it, but you just need to say Guillermo del Toro's next movie. I'm like, in, first day I'm in.
Yep.
With Crimson Peak, I don't know if just something was going on in my life at the time, but I wasn't fully as excited about it as I normally am with his films. And when I did see it, I thought to myself, well, of course, this is incredibly imaginative and it's gorgeous and it's atmospheric, but it didn't quite connect with me like it normally does. So after the first viewing, I mean, pretty far back, my favorite is still The Devil's Backbone.
Ah, nice.
And then probably Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth. Crimson Peak was kind of hanging out back there with movies I still really like, but like Mimic and Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
Watching it again, thanks to this set, it moved way up. I mean, yeah. Way, I appreciate it much more. So he hasn't yet made a movie I haven't at least liked. I would say Crimson Peak's now in the top five.
Yeah. No, I would say I had almost an identical reaction to yours, which is, I mean, I am the same way with him. I'm in from the word go, and I watched it and I liked it. I thought at the time it felt like I liked it more than a lot of people I knew, but I couldn't fully say that I loved it. And then rewatching it on this disc, and this transfer, although I don't know if it's advertised as a new scan, I don't think it is.
It
but,
doesn't say man, it, say that. Yeah, just that's high definition.
It looks. I feel like it looks better than the Blu-ray I had. I don't know. But I think there's something about this one that revisitation. This is my, I think, third or fourth time seeing it. And I'm really getting in a groove with the movie now in a way that I'm like, this is one of my favorites. Like, this is like top three, I think, for me, for him, you know. And I don't know, something about the way everything comes together, the visual design, the story stuff, the strong female characters.
I tried to articulate this through very strong female characters. You know, one that is in the present and one that is completely linked to the past. Very strong female characters, both. And not in any way idealized, but very, very strong. I wanted to reverse the idea of the damsel in distress being rescued by a male figure, and if possible, reverse it completely and have her find herself, which is the most important kind of love, and even save the male figure.
The ghosts. I mean, there's so many things I love about it that are starting to bubble up. So I hope this will give some people an opportunity to come back to it if they had maybe a slightly less than love the shit out of it response the first time. But yeah, just seeing it again was great. And then diving into all these features, I was like fully enamored myself.
Yeah, I remember seeing it the first time. I was disappointed. I didn't immediately fall in love with it because it is a gothic romance. I love gothic romance. I have paperbacks that are decades old. I like a lot of the literary allusions he makes, where maybe it's not full gothic romance, but it's still affected the screenplay. Like, he references Henry James a lot. He named a character after Edith Wharton, whose giant biography I've read.
I chose this period because I always thought, and I named Edith after Edith Wharton, because I thought it was a really interesting period in America, a period where everything was promise, everything was possible, you know?
I'm sitting in my library right now, painted in the color I chose, called Rembrandt Red.
Nice.
And, you know, I like the new school gothic romances, kind of like The 13th Tale, which came out in 2006. It's by Diane Sentenfield. And I actually thought about it a lot when I was rewatching this. Uh-huh. There's this quote in it called, all children mythologize their birth. And I thought about that line when I was watching this because, you know, this is that classic tale where there's the dark family secrets. And here, it's just like a twisted, thorny, dark fairy tale that they made true. There's just so much evil and darkness and violence that came to life. And I thought about Sarah Waters, too. You can tell Del Toro and Matthew Robbins, who he did the screenplay with, you can't really do a film like this if you're not a fan, because there is kind of an operatic feeling to it. It's quiet. It's kind of muffled. It's almost like a repressed opera.
Nice. Yeah.
And that really comes through. So seeing it, I got kind of angry at myself that I didn't fully appreciate it the first time. So I'm with you, absolutely. I think if maybe this one was a little cold to you when you first saw it, give it another chance. And all the extras on here, I think, frame it beautifully. And it's so worth it. This film was made with so much love and so much passion.
Yeah, I mean, I think he obviously put so much into Shape of Water in terms of love and passion, but I feel like this is just bursting. This is overflowing with stuff he loves, and it's dripping with passion in terms of the visual approach and the way that he feels about these characters. I don't know. I felt like he, and I'm probably wrong, but I felt like he, it was maybe more personal and more him even than Shape of Water is. And I could be reaching and just speculating completely, but it just feels like such a him movie. Yeah, I don't know. There's something really special about it.
I think that film has a narrative power beyond screenplay. And the real story on a movie, you should be able to basically watch with the volume down. The rest is dramaturgy, and I value it a lot. I love watching it, but I like making movies that are very rich worlds with very simple plots. Very complicated characters or very rich worlds, but the plot doesn't exactly peel my banana, if you would. You know, I like to keep it simple, but then create a world that's complex.
And I do like, especially as I get older, movies that surprise me upon rewatch. Because not to be cynical, but I do find that where, you know, people like you and me are at now in terms of the amount of movies that we've seen and the way that you could read a movie, sometimes within the first half an hour, and not to say that you know everything about how you're going to feel about it or you know everything about the movie, but you kind of get a vibe for it in the first 30 minutes and you go, okay, this is going to be a really special one, or I'm totally going to come back to this, or I'm a little disappointed, but I'm totally going to ride this out and maybe it'll surprise me. but often my first impressions are not too far off of how I'm going to ultimately feel about a movie.
Right.
And so when I find a movie that challenges that and sort of says, now, wait a minute, come back and watch this again. And suddenly I find myself sort of arguing with my initial impression. Then I'm like, well, that's a special movie. That's something that you don't get that much. So I like being wrong in that way. I like having my instincts be faulty. But I also think there's just certain movies that, especially, I think Guillermo is this way for sure. I just have really specific heightened expectations with him. And I should almost, at this point, not really trust my first viewing of any film of his, because I feel like I'm bringing too much in, and it's going to take some time to really figure out how I feel about it. I don't know if that's where you're at with him or not.
Yeah, Del Toro does seem like he is the human personification of passion and loving everything, which, you know, on a much, much, much lower level, I can really relate to. And I, you know, when he talks about, oh, I love the classic monsters and ghost stories and this and that, we're like, oh, yeah, of course, like, clearly, and we're right there with you. And then he moves and he's like, well, I'm going to do a period drama now. And there's going to be like incest and literary allusions and just drawn out creepiness. I think maybe that threw some of us off.
Yeah.
And he's just as interested in that. And he's just as informed about all that. But it's a little bit of a harder sell than like a cool monster movie.
Yeah, no, definitely.
But I will say the ghosts in this are incredible.
Oh, they really, that's one of the things of several that struck me this time. And then watching the featurettes where you see all, they're practical.
I know.
You know, I mean, they're,
he's like, yeah, we made the ribcage CGI, but that person was there. It's like, what?
Yeah. I mean, we don't have to go on and on about, you know, physical versus CG, but I really think in this case, it makes a big, big difference for the actors and for the mood. It just, it carries that gothic, you know, vibe over the top into another level for me. That they're there, you know, and they really are. He obviously is a guy who's seen a lot of movies. He has all, like you said, literary influences and things like that mixing in there. I mean, he's got art influences, you know, all in the pot there. And I just feel like he knows what's been done in terms of, and he's just a big horror fan, so he knows what's been done in terms of creature design and stuff like that. He respects that stuff, and I feel like he's bringing something different. And that's what, if I had to make one complaint about, you know, contemporary horror, it might be that I sometimes don't feel like people put enough time into their monster and creature design, or it's too derivative of other things, which I can totally appreciate. If I became a filmmaker on a regular basis, I'm sure I would be drawing from my favorite films probably more than anything. But he's clearly got so much more in his head that comes out, like, you just, like, the whole featurette on the ghosts, you see him directing one of them, and he's talking about specific movements. He's obviously just got this vision of not only what they look like, but how they move and how they interact in real space. And it really makes a difference, I think. Huge.
Right, because he himself is an artist. You can watch the features on all of his past movies, Hellboy, everything. And he has these complex director's notebooks with these beautiful illustrations. And he has a background in makeup effects as well. So there are a lot of directors who they'll kind of go to the department and let them know generally what they'd like. But with him, it's a vision. And
absolutely,
like you said, he knows horror films. And one of the featurettes, I think, is Mia Wasikowska. Or Wachowska, sorry.
Yeah, no, I get her name messed up all the time.
She was asking him about the more violent scenes, and he said, well, a lot of people, when they go into a horror movie, they have their guard up and they're ready to laugh. And even though he was referring to why he had more violent scenes in there, it shows how deeply he understands how it is. Because, there, you know, when you see a horror film in a theater, there's always going to be someone obnoxiously laughing at something that's really scary because they're uncomfortable, because they need to feel like they have the upper hand, because they're kind of embarrassed that they were affected in a certain way. And I think that's a great thing Crimson Peak pulls off. It's kind of a slow burn with some moments of genuine terror, and the end of it is relentless.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I mean, it was funny because seeing it for whatever I said, the third or fourth time, I still found myself genuinely frightened by at least two or three of the ghost sequences. The initial bed sequence is just so masterful. And there's something about just the fingers on that ghost coming over. It's just brilliant. It's really great.
Which I guess was based on a story his mom told him, like something that happened to her after a funeral, which I think those always make the scariest stories, like things you're told to when you're a child by your mom. And you're like, well, it's my mom that happened. And it just stays with you for decades.
Yeah, no, he definitely made a hell of a visual, you know, impression out of that story. You know, he really... I don't know. I really got to give credit to, I'm not like Mr. like can't be scared by anything. I'm not so jaded and or whatever about horror movies, but I do have to give, you know, credit when I'm kind of looking over my shoulder a little bit after something, or, you know, you get that initial rush of like, oh fuck, you know, like, right. You know, and I definitely had that this watch of the movie, and I watched it during the day. I didn't even watch it at night.
Right.
So that's even more points, right? Just briefly, so people that don't know the story of Crimson Peak, if you didn't see it at all, I forget, is it set in the 1800s, 1880s. Okay. Basically it's a story of a young woman played by Mia Wasikowska, who is a writer, and her dad is a blue-collar guy who's worked his way up with his own company. I forget what his company actually is. It construction? I don't fully remember what they do. Do you remember? It doesn't really matter.
I kind of assumed he was a captain of industry and dabbled there you in go. Everything. I think,
there you
and
go.
When it opens, she's a very modern, vibrant, go-getter kind of girl. It actually reminded me of the beginning of The Ghost in Mrs. Muir, the movie with Jean Tierney, when she's like...
I've never seen that movie.
Oh, well, the beginning is so great. She's a writer, and she's going into the publishing office, and she has to convince everyone that she, as a woman, has... been writing these certain stories, and it's a lot like the beginning of this, like, oh, you just go write about romances or something.
Yeah, that's...
I think there is a condescension to Edith everywhere. The father loves her, but ultimately cannot trust that she will make the right decision. And here she says a great line about she prefers Mary Shelley. She died a widow, which is tragically what she will end up like. Very prophetic, but very strong, because I think that she will find herself and her strength. Now, the condescending attitude the editor has with her is, to me, very personal. I identify with Thomas Sharp and with Edith, in that I'm always caught with the stories that are not ghost stories, but stories with a ghost in it. It's a declaration of principle. And I always encounter condescension.
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure... It feels to me like he's definitely a fan of Ghost and Mrs. Muir, based on what you're saying, because that sounds like a very similar opening. And I can't imagine, you know, what I know of that movie. Again, I've been meaning to see it for years. It seems like so exactly up his alley, you know, that I can't imagine that he wasn't kind of like, yeah, maybe I'll just do a little bit of that.
And, of course, a ghost writes a book with her.
Right? I mean, that's such a Guillermo kind of... I feel like there's a remake in the works there somewhere, you know? It seems like something he would do. But yeah, so she's a writer, and she is sort of smitten by a gentleman played by Tom Hiddleston, who is trying to get money for a sort of a industrial mining machine that will... It's like steam-powered, and... I don't know. His dad is very, or her dad, excuse me, is very skeptical of this guy, because they could see that Hiddleston and his sister, played by Jessica Chastain, have sort of sought money elsewhere and have failed. And so it seems like there's a reason why they're not connecting. There's something not quite right.
He brushes them right off.
Yeah. But so there's an initial conflict between the dad and him, but she and Hiddleston's character are kind of caught up with each other, and you know, it kind of goes from there. There's a potential relationship. There's other things bubbling underneath. I don't want to give away too much. If you haven't seen it, I really feel like you should just watch it. Trust your instincts about Guillermo and go with it. But in terms of the features, what I was just, there's too much. There's just too much stuff.
Where Arrow, list. Are you listening? We're complaining. There's actually too much. You need to not give us so much.
Knock it off. Cut it back. What are you doing? This is just, no, I'm kidding. This is great. I mean, it's just one of those things where I literally, between the other stuff I'm working on, I could not get through everything on this disc. So, I mean, I have my favorite stuff that I'll mention briefly, and then I want to hear some of the stuff that you enjoyed most. But I mean, I'm sure you enjoyed the ones I did too. You know, first would be the visual essay by Kat Ellinger.
Yeah, we are fans of her over here.
She's great. I mean, she's, I love, love, love that she's become a go-to for not one, not two, but like at least three companies that I can think of off the top of my head, maybe four. I feel like she did stuff for Shameless Media too, but like Arrow, Indicator, Kino Lorber.
Severance.
She is a go-to. Oh, Severance. Yeah. So there's like five. Yeah, it's great. No, she's wonderful. And I was a fan of hers and Sam Deegan's from their show, Daughters of Darkness, which unfortunately I don't know that they're doing as much anymore because they're so busy doing other stuff, which is great for us, you know, ultimately for fans of genre. It's a wonderful thing. But I do miss the show a little bit because they're so busy now. But yeah, Kat's essay is really great and touches on all kinds of thematics weaving through not just this film, but other films. And I love that kind of stuff, especially because it's the mindset I like to try and get into. And I'm not ever going to be a Kat Ellinger, you know, level person. But in terms of what we do on Pure Cinema specifically, a lot of times I'm thinking about thematics and things that can tie. Ultimately, when we're doing our pairings, I'm working on an episode right now where, you know, that kind of thing has come into play a little bit more. And it's kind of fun to start to see those connections. And she really has a lot of stuff that she brings up that I'm like, wow, how did I not catch some of these? But it's a really great overview. It's, I think I want to say it's like 24 minutes. And it covers, you know, a lot of his films, not just Crimson Peak, like I said.
Right.
But I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah. One thing I really like about her is she will acknowledge something that especially genre fans will notice. Like, she's like, yes, there are a lot of nods to Mario Bava in this. More of his films like Barren Blood and The Whip and the Body. But that won't be her whole thesis. She'll just be like, yes, let's all acknowledge this. And she'll jump off from that. And you'll assume that you know what she's going to talk about. And then she just goes deeper and deeper. And she just knows how to make it accessible and hook you in and then just pull you further and further in. I love her.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, anything like that where you come out the other side and you're like, I loved him before, but now seeing all these things that she's pointing out, I love him even more. It's just that kind of
thing. I'm going to get a tattoo of him on my face.
Exactly. That's the level that she brings up.
It will be beautiful.
I'm going to tattoo his face on my face. It's going to be awesome. But so yeah, she's great. That one's great. I also always love a good Kim Newman interview, and he's delightful. Like he just is one of those guys that like to me always seems like he's having fun when he's talking about this stuff, and that like hanging out with him would be just amazing. Getting a beer with him would be just fantastic.
I mean, he's very academic in a way. He has decades and decades and decades of experience. I have his books on my shelf, fiction and nonfiction. I love him, but he's always having a blast. It almost seems like every interview with him, he's already laughing and then he jumps into everything.
Yeah.
It's infectious.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's totally infectious. And he's always like spiffily dressed. This is a minor detail, but he's got a great look.
Oh, with the accent and the kind of pseudo modern Victorian garb. Yeah.
He wears a lot of like vests and almost like ascot-y right. kind of things. And not many people can sell that without either A, looking like a pretentious douche or just flat out looking stupid. And he, in his way and his manner, sells all of it.
Makes
like
it
he's
work.
Just, I'm like, this guy's the fucking bomb. I love him. And yeah, so he covers not only Crimson Peak, but sort of the tradition of Gothic romance in general.
Mm-hmm. It's Gothic romance. And those are terms that have been controversial and striking ever since the late 18th century.
And that is a great complementary thing to what Kat's doing, which is broader than that. But ultimately, those two together, combined with Guillermo's audio commentary, are probably my favorite three things on here. And then I like the ghosts featurette also. But I didn't, like I said, I didn't get to everything. So I'm sure that you have other things that you loved, and I want to hear about them.
Well, you stole my favorites as
well. I'm sorry.
Well. I will say I really love about Del Toro's commentaries is his films are pure magic. And I would say my favorite fictional genre is magical realism, like Umberto Eco kind of things. And I feel like he is the idealized filmic version of magical realism. And when I watch his movies, I'm completely transported. I buy into everything. But on his commentaries, he's not being evasive. He's not trying to keep secrets. He lets you know how everything's made. He gives credit to all the people who work on it. And the way he delivers it, it creates a completely different kind of magic. You know, it's almost like the magician. He's like, okay, this is how the tricks are done. But isn't that cool? Isn't that like a form of art on its own that we can even achieve this at all? And I'm sitting there, I'm like, hell yes. So if you want to suspend all belief, I guess don't listen to the commentary. But if you can separate things, if you like learning about it, he gets so specific. But it's fun to listen to. It's not dry.
And on this first Ghost, the only digital portion, aside from the ectoplasm, is that we created the hollow in its head. This is one of my favorite shots in the movie. It's a single shot, and I think it's really quite beautiful. It's quite a beautiful moment. It's probably my favorite ghost apparition in the film. And again, it's completely done physically with just the hollow, and the ball becomes a little homage to a movie I love called The Changeling, which has a great moment with George C. Scott and a little bouncing red ball.
Yeah, no, it's not dry. And if anything, the more I hear him, the more I'm like, this man is a poet. This man has the soul of a Renaissance painter. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's such a depth of intelligence beyond your average filmmaker. And I have a great deal of respect for a lot of your average filmmakers. I have a great deal of respect for all filmmakers, to be honest. It's not easy.
I don't know how any movie gets made ever. It seems insane. Right? So yeah, respect to everybody.
For sure. But listening to him talk, I'm just like, oh my God, this guy is so much more than a filmmaker. He's got so much going on in there. And the passion and the depth of expression from which these things come is stunning. And I always come away hearing him, I'm always like, God damn, that guy. Wow. He's something else.
Oh, man. This might be our most fangirl segment we've done together so far. I love it.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that I could really listen to talk about anything, you know, movies or not. He really has something interesting to say. What other stuff on here? I mean, there's so many featurettes. What else did you like on here?
Yeah. The main thing I really liked, it's called The House is Alive, and it's just over an hour, and it's a really well-edited documentary. They talk to Del Toro, of course. They talk to all the actors, and it's interesting because the actors, it's some of the more lucid understanding I've ever heard from actors about what's going on in the film. And that's not meant as an insult to actors normally. I think he just, like, he wrote each of them their own character Bibles. I think he really wanted them to understand every little aspect of this. And I think people who work with him are just as enchanted as the audiences. So it's pretty in depth. And especially if you're interested in the actors proper. I know a good amount of people who are in love with Jessica Chastain. And I never fully understood. I'm like, yeah, she's a great actress and she's beautiful, but, you know. And then just seeing how she analyzed everything going on in the film, I was like, oh, okay, I'm in love with Jessica Chastain.
Love takes a big part of this movie. It's a gothic romance. Guillermo had talked to me in the very beginning about it being a movie about two different kinds of love. But, you know, there's a love that Lucille has and a love that Edith has. And for Lucille, for my character, she's a woman that desperately wants to feel love and intimacy. But also in her, because of her trauma, her scars, her history that she comes from, she associates suffering with intimacy. And love, I think, is the reason Crimson Peak works. Because in a way, a selfless love actually wins at the end.
There's an unreleased interview with Del Toro that's in Spanish.
Yeah.
And there are some things that came over from the original Blu-ray release. There's a lot of featurettes that are really featurettes. They run like just under 8 minutes. And they're really interesting. They deconstruct different parts of the movie. Like they go through the house. They look at the ghosts. My only complaint is I wish there was a play all for that, because constantly clicking enter after like 7 minutes, it's like, oh, okay, I just kind of want to lose myself in this right now. And also I'm very lazy.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there should be a way to do that, especially when you've got a bunch of short little featurettes. Either stitch them together or do something so that you don't have to just go out to the menu. And then sometimes what happens to me is when you're dealing with as many as you are here, I'm like, oh, what did I just watch? Okay, and then I end up clicking on the one I just watched. I'm like, wait, no. Okay, go to the next one. You know, that kind of thing.
This menu, it automatically goes to the next one. So at least it does have that. And then the box itself, I've been trying not to say the word sumptuous too often, because I could use it in every sentence. The box is sumptuous. It has a poster. Mm-hmm. It has 4 beautiful postcards, and I'm not really one who displays posters or anything, but if you're into that, it's stunning. And the big draw for me is there's a little hardcover book in here.
Yes.
It's full color. It has beautiful photographs. It has drawings. It has 3D models, and it has, let's see, it has 3 essays and a review from Kim Newman in it.
It's awesome. It's such a neat thing to open up this book packaging and you've got another book inside.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. Yeah. This is one of those where they have the little string so that you can lift all the shit up to get to the disc itself.
Yeah, it has the string, and then the hardcover book has its own slipcase. And here, I'll knock on the book right now.
Solid.
Come on.
That is solid. That's the most solid knock of any knocks I think we've had on the show. So that should mean something. It's an amazing package. I really think we both would agree that we can't recommend it highly enough. It's a must have. It's going to be, you know, in the running for top release of 2019. And I know we're only in February right now, but it's clearly one of those, if you will.
If this doesn't make my top 10, then I can't even imagine what else is gonna come out this year.
I mean,
seems like a shoo-in.
Not to be pessimistic, but I just don't think there's any way. No. It's not
pessimistic. They just went that
exactly.
Whoever really spearheaded this release loves this movie.
Yeah,
bless
them. Yeah, and that I can really feel. And that when you're collectors hardcore like we are, I think sometimes that seeps into my subconscious, and when I'm going back to rewatch the movie, I'm just like, this is, you can't not hold this thing in your hand and not go, this is important. You know, it's just one of those kind
of
things.
That's true. No, it's absolutely influential. Like, sorry to go off topic, but I have the Blu-ray of Blue Sunshine,
mm-hmm.
and I love that movie. I originally saw it on Elvira's show where she was making fun of it. I just happened to say, oh, I loved it. So I went ahead, and it's like a small company. I think that was the first Blu-ray they actually made. And I bit the bullet. And do you have the Blu-ray?
I do have it.
Okay, so yeah, you get it. It has this beautiful slipcase. You open it. It has the soundtrack. It has campaign stickers. It has a fake blot of acid in it.
That's an awesome touch.
It's just, yeah, I think I was seduced into allowing myself to appreciate the film even further because I'm like, well, this movie has to be onto something if someone cared this much about it.
Totally. No, I agree. I mean, there's few, you know, people always point to, say, the Armageddon Criterion DVD as maybe something where you're like, well, maybe not everything.
Okay, that's one of the best commentaries of all time.
Also. I'm not even arguing the movie's not good. I'm not arguing it's not worthy of that. But I think some people will sometimes point to that one. But yeah, it definitely, there's no way that you can't look at some of these releases that we're getting in the last 2-3 years and not understand how passionate the people behind the scenes are about these movies to take the time and care and expense to put all this together, you know, in hopes that you respond the same way.
Right. And it's Arrow. Like, they had to get the rights for it and they had to specifically pick out the movie.
Yeah, this is a big deal for them because I don't know that they've done a ton of, like, we're talking about Universal Pictures. Like, they don't do a ton of that kind of licensing as far as I know, you know. A lot of times they're dealing with smaller genre movies that, you know, are owned by smaller companies and not, especially not one that's already been released by Universal in a, you know, fine Blu-ray package. But yeah, to do that and then they really were aware that they had to step it up because they know that a lot of people that like the movie already bought that original Blu-ray and, you know, what do you got for me that's going to make me want to, you know, buy it again? And let me tell you, it's definitely one of those that is the very definition of double dipping, why you would do it, you know?
Yes. And I think it surprised a lot of people because Criterion they've been doing such an amazing job releasing his films. They even did that beautiful box set that I have.
That's right.
So I think if they were going to double dip, everyone assumed it'd be Criterion. This release specifically is Region A, the one we're talking about specifically. So they got the North American rights. Like, not Criterion. We have Crimson Peak.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's a thing, and I don't know, I don't want to make any assumptions about Criterion and what their approach to the films are, but maybe they weren't as big of fans of this one, apparently. Or why didn't they snap it up? But regardless, it doesn't matter, because I don't think we would have gotten this level, and certainly not the special packaging and everything. I mean, Criterion's done that a little bit recently, but I feel like they're at a point now where they're like, we know what we need to do and we know how much money we can spend and will spend. And even on the Guillermo releases, outside of that box, which is a great box, right? I don't think you would have gotten something like this from them if they had done it.
Like, you wouldn't have a poster or anything like that.
No.
So it's, yeah, delightful. I hope it's not them being highfalutin. I hope it's like a bidding war, because I have their old DVD of Blood of Dracula, and you can't be highfalutin if you release that.
It's true. You know, I mean, granted that, you know, personnel changes and things, you know, data that they have based on what people buy and don't buy, but they got to know that horror titles are a hot commodity. And maybe it was a bidding war. Maybe it was one of those, but anyway, we benefit because we got a great special edition and you got to get it. That's the bottom line in my mind. We should move on to your next pick here, unless you have a few more comments.
After we trash talk Criterion.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely not trash talking, but you know what I mean? Like, there's just certain movies that...
Label wars.
What?
Label wars.
Label wars. You know, I mean, I think the horror movies, they have some respect for, but they don't necessarily have the people at Criterion that feel the same way about horror movies that, you know, Jeff Nelson does or the guys at Arrow do. It's just a different thing. You know, they have a breadth, which I love about them, you know, mm-hmm. It's great. And Arrow is not really necessarily about the breadth, and that's okay. You know what I mean? They have Arrow Academy. That's another thing, and that's great too. But anyway, unless you have anything else you want to add about this one, we can move to the next one.
Get it. And yeah. I think that's the bottom line. Venn diagram of Del Toro fans and people who probably collect Blu-rays is pretty much a circle. So yep. You won't be disappointed in this.
And he's clearly a guy that appreciates collectors and is, I would guess, a collector himself.
Have you ever seen any tours of his house? Good Lord.
I have. I mean, he's a collector of things, certainly, and I would imagine Blu-rays as well. But yeah, he's a made for Blu-ray and special features kind of director. So like, yeah, this is an obvious you must have it kind of thing. So your next pick is Mikey and Nikki, which is director Elaine May's third film, I want to say. A New Leaf, Heartbreak Kid. Yeah, third film from 1976.
Give me some milk and some cream and separate cartons to go.
You just got milk.
No cream?
Not to go.
What are you putting in the coffee here? You have any cream?
Use these little bottles here.
All right, give me 15 of those little bottles to go. Give me a couple of cartons of milk.
I can't do that. We don't give these bottles to go. If you want coffee to go, I put the cream in right here and I use the dispenser right back there, sir.
All right, give me a carton of cream and the dispenser.
How many coffees?
Well, no coffees. Just fill up a carton of cream.
Can't do that. I wouldn't know what to charge you. Cream is for the coffee only. It's not for sale.
Charge me for 15 coffees and give me the cream.
15 coffees?
That's right.
Okay.
You give me that in 30 seconds, you hear me, or I'll kill you.
Okay, sir.
Because I'm crazy.
Okay.
Now give it to me.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just give it to me.
Okay.
Give it to me. Come near me and I'll kill you.
And that's a hell of a run of great movies, by the way. I love, like, Heartbreak and New Leaf are two of my absolute drop-dead favorite films of all time. And so she wouldn't have to do anything else. And this one is, interestingly, another one, like Crimson Peak, that I was initially slightly disappointed by.
Okay.
The first time I saw it. But only because I had expectations of a comedy.
Right.
And that it wouldn't, and I'm proven completely wrong in my impressions, that it wouldn't feel more like a John Cassavetes movie than an Elaine May movie. This disc has come to make me understand the what I should have from the very beginning, which is this is 100% an Elaine May movie. And she wrote every stitch of dialogue in the movie. None of it is improvised. But she cast it. And in choosing, the two stars of this film are Peter Falk and John Cassavetes. So if you watch it in the context of what Cassavetes was doing around this time, specifically something like Killing of a Chinese Bookie, it's hard not to kind of go, oh, this feels more like that than what Elaine May is doing. But anyway, what is your deal with Mikey and Nikki? Like, when did you come to it, and what did it do when you saw it in terms of your impressions?
I have kind of a strange, muddled history with it. I don't come to it an expert or anything. I'm a huge fan of Elaine May. I very much admire female comedians, especially ones who had to start in decades where it was a little harder to get that going. And the fact that she constantly, I don't even think it was an active thing she did where she's like, well, you think I'm one thing, but I'll show you. I got layers. She was just a very complex, layered person. She still is. And she's just, I think, fascinated by people. I think she is very taken by people, but she sees people for exactly what they are. She can see right under the skin. And the way she brings that out in her work is incredible to me. It's so raw. It's almost like someone who you have the utmost respect for completely dressing you down for every stupid, terrible thing you've done in your life. And then they just pull you into an embrace and you're like, okay, I can be better. I can make it. That's what her films feel like to me. And I'm with you on this movie that I swear to God, I always want to call it Mikey and Nikki.
Me too. I have
the opening scene, you know, John Cassavetes, he's in a really bad way, and Peter Falk is kind of comedically breaking down his door to get into the flea bag motel, and he's trying to get him through like a paranoid freak out.
You understand me?
die. I'm gonna die.
My God.
You know, I don't shave. Did you know that? I don't want to take care of myself. I think if I don't take care of myself and I sit still and I don't move, maybe they'll forget about me. But then I'm scared of that, too, because I think maybe if I sit there too long, maybe when I want to move, I won't be able to move.
You sound like you're ready for a straitjacket.
I'm going to die.
Come on. You're not going to die.
You see the picture of Ed Lipsky in the paper? You see it on Tuesday? In Tuesday's paper?
Yeah, that was terrible.
He was all shot up. His neck was broken. You see that?
But, you know, nobody thought he had anything to do with Lipsky, Nick. He was in the clear.
There's a contract on. There's a contract out on Ed Lipsky and me. I know that for a fact. Resnick put it out. I know it for a fact. They're going to kill me.
Nick.
They're going to kill me.
You are not going to die. Oh, boy. I mean, even if somebody wants to kill you, that doesn't mean you're going to die.
They're going to kill me.
I want you to stop.
And it's funny. It's like kind of the gritty 70s kind of humor, but it's funny. And so you're like, ah, of course. You know, this is what I came here for. And then it just turns into a dark goddamn night of the soul.
Yeah.
So I can, yeah, it disarms you. It's so brilliant, but ooh, it's not a relaxing movie.
No. No, I mean, for those that don't know, like you said, you more or less explained it, but the freak out he's having, Cassavetes' character is having, is that he thinks he's going to get killed. He thinks that he has done something. These are low-level mob guys, which, by the way, I love the features on this. We can get into it, but one of the things that I texted you about is, like, apparently Elaine May grew up in a sort of a family that was connected to the mob.
Yeah.
I never, ever would have gotten that impression. So these guys, and this is where it comes into it being her film more than Cassavetes, is that she knew guys like this. Supposedly this is, it's based on a story that her brother told her about a hitman and a friend of his. And I won't talk about where that story goes because it tells the ending of the movie. And I really don't want to spoil that for people. But yeah, so these are the kind of low-level mob guys, blue-collar guys, you know, that she had experience with. And so it's a very personal in that respect, maybe more personal than anything else she ever made in a lot of ways. And yeah, I think there was an initial impression that I got that was like, in seeing the way that Falk and Cassavetes interact, I will always think of Cassavetes films. Those guys are the very fabric of what he does in terms, right, of the way they interact and how they talk to each other and how it feels improvisational because they go off in these weird tangents that are just like almost like acting exercises, but they're able to bring it back around and make it real. But my initial impression was like, oh, Cassavetes just fucking steamrolled Elaine May and made a fucking Cassavetes movie. So fucking stupid and short-sighted and naive of me. But that's what I thought the first time I saw it. I was like, this doesn't feel like the other stuff. But then coming back to it more and more, I start to see more of her and what she's trying to do. And listening to the features and stuff, it all started to fall into place. And as with Crimson Peak, I appreciated the movie more after going through this, you know?
Well, that's the biggest value of Blu-rays, in my opinion. I mean, it's important to see them restored. And films that might have been lost for years and years, they finally get a great release. But I think what makes them different from restoring it and then putting it on streaming, which I'm thrilled they do, with Blu-rays, you have the space to frame them, to add education, to add like the human warmth behind the film. And you can see, hopefully, the people who actually worked on the film. You can see people who have dedicated their life to analyzing the film. And I think that's wonderful. And you know, I think I've done enough episodes of this. I don't think it's a secret that I love Blu-rays. But that, you know, and back in the DVD days and, you know, for you laser discs, that's always been so incredibly important to me. And I think that's what actually sparked my interest from going to like, oh yeah, I love movies, to becoming a little bit obsessed and caring very deeply about them. And this is a fantastic example of it. You're right. I really didn't know much of anything about the making of it. I knew that May has had a hell of a time making a lot of her films.
Yeah.
I would say Ishtar is the most famous story out there, but you know, it's no secret she had to deal with a lot of bullshit. And unfortunately, she is not in the special features.
Yeah, that's the one big bummer, unfortunately. I think there is an interview that I found with her and Mike Nichols. It's on stage, maybe at one of the venues in New York, where they kind of go through a bunch of her career, and I believe they touch on this film a little bit. But I don't think she's big on interviews. That's not her jam, really. She's also, I think, like 80 years old.
I was watching a show on Netflix called Somebody Feed Phil. And it's the guy who created the Everybody Loves Raymond sitcom. And it's a travel show he does where he goes to different countries and just eats all their food. And
oh, that's right. Yeah, I know this. I've heard of this. Yeah.
Yeah, it's delightful. And there's a scene where he's just eating ice cream with Elaine May.
Nice.
I'm like, what? And she's so vibrant and beautiful and youthful, and she's just eating the ice cream and she gets some in her hair. It's so charming. And I swear, when they announced they were releasing this, I immediately thought of that episode. I'm like, oh, she's going to be all over it. Because she's just so vibrant.
They could just get her some ice cream.
Yeah. Come on, Criterion, just offer her some ice cream. Make it fun for her. So, you know, it's not that she's like retiring into a Crimson Peak kind of place or anything. She's out there. She's still kicking ass. So I don't know if it's a scheduling thing or darkness connected to this film specifically, but I did get my hopes up.
Yeah.
Mostly due to ice cream.
I mean, you can find her, you can find that Mike Nichols interview online. It's not bad. I mean, you know, it's interesting to hear her talk about stuff relating to her career. And the amount of films she got made in the time that she did is quite miraculous, unfortunately, because so few films were being made by major studios. And it, obviously, that's not necessarily that different now, but by female directors at the time that she was coming up. And the fact that she got, you know, three good ones in the 70s is more than a lot of women can say, sadly. And they're great films. So, like, that's a whole other thing. But I was wrong about her age. She is 86 fucking years old. And
salute.
This is something that always struck me. Just a quick aside. When I was watching Heartbreak Kid, which is, again, one of my favorite films of all time, her daughter, Jeannie Berlin, plays opposite Charles Grodin. And I was like, wow, her daughter's, you know, older, like in her, you know, I don't know, 20s or something in that movie in like the mid, early 70s. I'm like, how old must she have been when she had her daughter? And I looked it up and I did the math. She was 17 years old when she had her daughter. So on top of everything else, on top of all that she's accomplished, she's been a mother since she was 17. I'm just like that.
Did she sleep?
I don't know. But my respect level for her is beyond off the charts. There is no fucking charts for her.
Yeah. Wow. I had no
idea. I was starting to put it together. I'm like, God, they look, she looks old for, you know, I think she directed A New Leaf when she was in her 40s and stuff like that. And so anyway, I was just like, wow, there's a story there that I don't know and I wasn't able to do enough research to figure out. But that's very interesting,
right,
too.
And that another thing is she wasn't just going up and saying, hey, I have some clout studios. You have any scripts floating around you think would be cute? Like, she crackerjack writer, and her films took chances. Major, major chances.
Yeah.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, no, I try not to even use the phrase female filmmaker anymore. You know, I just want it to be all filmmakers. And she is legit one of my favorite filmmakers ever. And she hasn't made that many movies. It's about the quality of film. It's about the comic vision that she has, which is not accidental. I mean, that comes from years of, you know, doing her own thing with Mike Nichols and just being an incredibly intelligent and funny person on top of everything else. And obviously able to make a film, you know. And I mean, the New Leaf Blu-ray from Olive is one of my favorite releases in recent memory, because it does give a decent amount of extras to a movie that I love. But if you watch that movie, especially the beginning where they're setting up the Walter Matthau character and the way that that is edited and shot, it's just so wonderful. It's so fucking funny. And it's really hard to do comedy and maintain a tone, especially like the one she's got going there. She makes it look easy. She really makes it look easy. Same thing with Heartbreak Kid. There's some really dark stuff happening in both movies, and I think you can really lose people pretty quickly when you start going into that territory. And she has such a warmth about her that I think comes through in all, in this movie as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, despite it being the tagline to this movie, which I love, is don't expect to like them. You know, which is funny, because it's kind of true. I mean, they're two tough characters to like a little bit, but there is something so, especially the way that they treat women in this movie, that's very tough, and does not help with their likability. But especially Cassavetes. But it's one of those things where she has such an ability with actors and getting the real human performance on the screen that draws you in. You know, she's, I don't know, I feel that, you know, stronger about her than I do about Guillermo, and I love Guillermo. You know, we're talking about two filmmakers who just really have a vision and just pull you into the movie. They just grab you by the collar and just bring you in. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's really not easy.
No, it's not. And I think her experience being on stage doing improv with emotional set pieces with Nichols gave her great experience and power in being able to write like this. And it's interesting earlier when you brought up that you assumed it was like it became a Cassavetes film, because I did think back to one of my favorite films of all time that absolutely destroys me, which is A Woman Under the Influence.
Oh.
And there's, you know, Peter Falk is in it, of course, is directed and written by Cassavetes, and with some of the women in this film reminded me a little bit of Jenna Rollins in that. But the interesting thing was A Woman Under the Influence is brilliant. And Jenna Rollins, I think that's one of probably the top 10 roles on just acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, no. On film. It's staggering and heartbreaking. Oh. And she's the one who brings it to life, but it's still very much from a man's point of view watching her behavior. And it's sympathetic. It's really well done. But, you know, when you mention you don't want to say female filmmaker, that's great. And we shouldn't have that disambiguation. But at the same time, especially in the time period Elaine May was actively working, there was an impact. So
for sure.
In this film, we're shown like the warmth of the friendship between Mickey and Nikki. Nope. Mikey and Nikki. And there's a lot of real warmth there. And you're like, oh, these two pals, they're screw ups, but they'll make it through. And then you see how they are with women and you see the darkness. And I feel like that's a woman who needs to do that, because men have a lot of faces. And I'm not sure if a lot of men are aware of that or if they don't want to confront that.
I'm sure both.
And Elaine May has seen those faces. She's seen the face of a man charming in a diner and chumming around with his friends and, you know, walking home after dinner, telling her jokes. And then when the door is closed, being absolutely abusive. And then you wake up the next morning and different variations of that the next day. And that hit me where I lived, because I think most women and most people can relate to that. And it's, you know, there's no shortage of hard-hitting, realistic, gritty filmmaking. But that turn, I don't see that too often, especially done that naturalistically. And normally with a lot of films, when you see that turn, now they're the bad guy, you know, now it's all darkness. But this one, like, no, these are still technically our protagonists. We're going with them. We're leaving this poor woman behind. We're still going with them. And it's so powerful. And it hurts.
Yeah.
It's an experience, but it's real. It's honest. And, I think it was an interesting time where I think some people see how the women were treated in this, and they might look at it as maybe exploitative, maybe kind of reductive. But I think it was an interesting time with feminism where for so many decades, women just had to be cheerful or they were set decorations. And this was more of a period where I don't feel like the women were shown to be weak here. I think they were just, we were being shown the brunt of everything they had to take. And that was a big deal to show that and be honest about that. And showing that is why we could build on that and show strong, kick-ass women later on. But we kind of had to address that really ugly underbelly that's always been there.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's very ugly. And that's hard to watch. But she really wants to give the whole picture of these guys and what their lifestyle is like. And it doesn't feel like it's not, like you said, honesty. It feels honest, you know. They have a charisma about them, that palling around stuff. But they're blue-collar guys. They're blue-collar criminals, you know. They're living in a dark place kind of all the time. You know, and that doesn't just stay in the work that they do, that goes home with them, and it affects everybody they live with. And, you know, there's, I don't know, there's just something about that honesty that I responded a lot more to seeing it again this time, you know, because I think I love John Cassavetes. I love the way he approaches his filmmaking, and I love even more how much he inspired Martin Scorsese and how much we see Marty taking what he's doing and bringing it, in my mind, don't shoot me, to another level in terms of incorporating it into popular Hollywood filmmaking. You know, Cassavetes, I feel like I love him and I love his films, but he very much is doing that thing and getting lost in his thing. And sometimes I feel like I said, there's a sense of acting exercises, and I'm showing my own lack of sophistication in terms of how I take in some of his material. Cause I'm just like, well, that feels real, but it also feels like two people sort of riffing and not necessarily conversing. And I know that they are, it's all about connection with him, but sometimes I'm taken out slightly by some of the weird tangents that characters go on in Cassavetes movies. So I don't know. There's something about this movie that, especially this time, it just was starting to click into place in a different way and brought about a whole new, not that I needed to have any more respect for Elaine May because I already think she's amazing, but I was suddenly like, wow, she's, you know, maybe, I mean, obviously Cassavetes is making films in the 60s, so he's doing his thing already. But in some ways, I feel like he almost could have been influenced by her, you know, like in some of the things she's doing. And then Killing of Chinese Bookie, I think, comes out the same year as this movie. And I kind of wonder, like, you know, did Elaine May have some kind of influence on Cassavetes? I mean, it's hard to know, you know, but
I would think, yeah, so. It was just spirit of collaboration.
Yeah. Exactly. I can't imagine somebody encountering her and A, not being completely swept away by her charm and her sense of humor and her intelligence, but also understanding that she is just working on a plane that is really high up in terms of artistry and filmmaking, and not, and how do you not respond to that as another artist, you know, like Cassavetes? So kind of makes sense, you know.
No, I think you're right on, because with Cassavetes, I think you're right on. He didn't mind if things were staged like it was on stage. It was all about the characters and their performances. And with Scorsese, he's an incredibly cinematic filmmaker. And I think why he is who he is because he values scripts and really building those characters as much as he does the aesthetics. But he needs it to look good. He needs it to, you know, sweep the audience into a brand new world. And he's incredible at it. And I think Elaine May had that understanding. And if things went smoother for her, if she got the chances she deserved, I think we would be talking about her in much the same way. Because I think she probably had a better understanding of how things translated from stage to film than Cassavetes.
I think so too. I mean, you look at, again, look at New Leaf.
Yeah, especially.
As a first feature, a first feature, it is incredible. It is incredible. And it's not even the movie that she wanted to make. I mean, you know, the cut that you see is not what she wanted to put out there. You know what I mean? So that is another thing. But she is so assured in terms of that vision. Yeah, it's incredible. It's really incredible. I can't praise her enough, because I just continue to, I come back to those films again and again, and I'm just like floored, absolutely floored, because they're just not, there are other films that kind of try to go where she goes in terms of the darkness and the comedy and despicable characters somehow made likable. And I feel like, you know, a lot of filmmakers are able to get close and do things that I am still, you know, sort of knocked over by, in terms of like, I can't believe you got me to care about so-and-so, and laugh at that in the midst of this whatever crisis, you know. But yeah, she's just doing something that's, I don't know, it's so special. It's so special. I like you say, I wish she'd been given more opportunities, but I can only imagine how fucking awful it must have been to work inside the studio system in the 1970s. That's ridiculous. But anytime now, you know, the Ishtar thing, I mean, I would imagine that you would burn out on that really quickly, even as a dedicated artist and somebody who is assertive and self-assured and is just like, I'm going to do this. There's a point where I just can't blame somebody for being like, this is just too much. This is too much. I can't deal with this, you know? So it's too bad.
Yeah. Making a film is a huge strain, even if things go well. I can't imagine that. And I think what elevates her material, like you said, there's a lot of people who were influenced by her, or maybe not influenced by her specifically, but, you know, they want to do that gritty character-based kind of film. Her sense of humor and her empathy is incredible. It's just as strong as her filmmaking and writing ability. And you can learn how to write a script. You can learn how to write a better script. You can learn about how to work cameras and stage things, but you can't learn empathy.
Yeah. You can't learn the deftness of mixing the empathy with the dark comedy and still making somebody... I mean, I'll never get over the stuff she does with Charles Grodin in The Heartbreak Kid, because he's... I mean, for those that don't know, the premise of that movie is basically that he gets married, and on his honeymoon drive down to Miami Beach, he suddenly is starting to have second thoughts. Maybe this wasn't a good idea. And, you know, both men and women, I guess, could maybe relate to that idea. But then to see him in action, you're just like, oh, this is awful. This is terrible. You know, how awful. Oh, but he and Elaine May, they're able to make that funny and human, and you're able to understand why he would do this, and that he is ultimately a lost soul, and that is that empathy thing that you're talking about. And I think that is the thing that, when you get to the end of that movie, that really elevates it, really makes it more than just like a shitty guy doing shitty things. You know, it's really remarkable.
Yeah, she never forced anyone to be like, no, he's kind of a cad, but you'll love him by the end. Or, no, it's all black and white and they're terrible and you'll hate him by the end. I think she's just incredible at opening it up so you can see yourself. Like, okay, maybe you're not a hitman, but you could probably see some uncomfortable things about yourself in him. And goddamn, she just opens that right up. And at the end, I mean, I guess there's kind of a war between, wow, that was incredible and I was really challenged, to like, oh, what do I do now though? Like, how do I process?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely one of those movies that is incredibly impactful throughout, but definitely by the ending. Yeah, the ending is. I don't want to. I hate how, you know, you don't want to spoil anything, but you can tell when you're listening to people talk about a movie, you're like, you can tell what they're talking about. So it's hard not to give a little bits away. But yeah, it's. I was so excited when it got announced, and again, I love getting these discs, sitting down with it, knowing how I think I feel about something, and then being able to suddenly get context and see it again now as the person I am right now with all the things I have going on with me right now and how that plays into it. And I've certainly become more empathetic to a whole lot of characters that I didn't think I would empathize with as I've gotten older. And that's not saying I'm suddenly a criminal, but it's just one of those things where as you get older, you see enough stuff. And
what about Ned Beatty?
Oh boy. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. But he's great in the movie. Like, he's really, really good.
I'm not even going to break even on this.
Yeah. He's fucking, I love Ned Beatty so much.
No, I love him every time he pops up.
He's awesome. But so what, now, in terms of features, what did you, there isn't a ton on this, but I feel like what's here is pretty fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, there's an interview with Julian Schlossberg and actor Joyce Van Patten, who I want to say plays Cassavetti's wife in the movie. Is that right?
One of the wives, I think so, yeah.
So she's got a real specific memory of it. And Schlossberg, I can't remember if he was like, he wasn't a producer, but there's also an interview with him and Peter Falk from 1976. It's like a radio show interview. That is the next best thing to Elaine May is hearing Peter Falk talk about. It's like, I want to say it's like 45 minutes or something. And he talks about his career. He talks about this movie specifically quite a bit and gives an emotional and character context that I really appreciated and that helped me understand the movie a little better, you know, just get a better handle on it. Because it will seem, I think, to some people going in, especially if you haven't seen a Cassavetes movie, it's going to seem like disorganized. It's going to seem like meandering or something in a way that you may be put off by initially. And I wouldn't blame you, but I feel like once you come back to it again and maybe you've seen a little bit more Cassavetes, it might help. But yeah, hearing Falk talk about it was great, and hearing Schlossberg talk about Elaine May's mob connection was really interesting. What did you dig from these features here?
Yeah, like, you know, it's not, especially talking about after Crimson Peak, which has like 87 hours of extra features, it seems like. It's a tight package, but it's high quality. And a lot of times I prefer that because sometimes you'll make a big time investment to a disc, but there's a lot of repetition and filler in it. I learned something from every level of this, including the booklet essay.
Oh, which I didn't read, damn it.
Oh, you'll like it. I think especially people who are interested in this film, it's clean, it's informative, and it'll enrich your appreciation of the movie. So all killer, no filler, pretty much. And of course, I wish there's an Elaine May commentary on it, but you know. It's not Christmas.
Yeah. No, I do too. I do too. But like I said, you got 46 minutes with Peter Falk. That's pretty great. And then you have the Schlossberg and Joyce Van Patten. And then you've got another one that I loved was new interviews with critics Richard Brody and Kerry Rickey. And they are both fantastic. You know,
they had great insight. I really enjoyed that.
As a brilliant improviser, she wanted, in her films, spontaneity. She wanted the feeling of life being created immediately on film.
Come on.
In the case of Mikey and Nikki, she was dealing with actors of vast, I would call it literary imagination. And so they transformed her script the way that, you know, jazz musicians would transform themes.
Take it.
What is it?
Take it.
I don't want this.
Take it or I'll shove it down your throat. I'll open your mouth.
I'm gonna vomit it up. I want water. Listen, I want water with it.
If you vomit, I will give you another one.
What is that?
Pride.
What is that?
It's poison.
What is it?
Check yourself.
I've recently wondered about Elaine May's choice of actors in Mikey and Nikki. She knew Falk from co-starring with him in Love. She would know Cassavetes, you know, through Falk or around. Rose Arick, who plays Mikey's wife in this, was a Compass player that Elaine May knew from as far back as her Chicago days.
What did you go? Did you go inside the theater?
Sanford Meisner and William Hickey, who are the mob bosses, are also kind of the theater mob bosses. They were Stanislavski purists.
What do you think they're planning? To shoot you in a movie house? If they were planning something, they wouldn't be in the theater.
I think Meisner had left the Actors Studio after a fight with Lee Strasberg because Lee Strasberg was pushing effective memory.
I want you to do me a favor.
Mikey and Nikki might be a parable of acting, you know, the acting mafia, and who stole from the acting mafia and needs to be killed.
I don't remember you doing shit for me!
Acting is writing with words, but it's also writing with the body in a certain way. It's almost choreographic.
You're a piece of nothing.
There's a scene in the film where they have a fight in the street, where they roll around together, and it almost plays like a love scene. They move through the streets like dancers. It's a very intensely physical film. The camera is really agile. The camera focuses on details, it focuses on gestures. Just as Cassavetes and Falk have an intensely physical style of acting, May creates an intensely physical style of camera work to go with it.
Totally. They are the absolute Kim Newmans of this thing in terms of the
not as snazzily dressed, but they were great.
Although, you know, Brody's rocking a pretty killer beard. I gotta say, I wish I could grow a beard like that. That'd be something. But they both obviously love this film and love her and her way of making films, and they have a lot of thematic insights and things that you listen and you're like, oh wow, I hadn't approached it that way. I hadn't thought about it that way. And it's really great. Just very passionate.
Yeah, it's not dry or snooty or anything like that. They really love her and they love this movie.
Yeah, I want to say it's about an hour and 15 minutes of stuff, something like that.
Altogether?
All told. Yeah, I want to say maybe it's an hour and 20 because it's 45 and I want to say like 15 and 15-ish.
You're getting too mathy for me. I'm out.
I don't know. I'm just guessing. But so, like you say, though, really solid in terms of what you have inside of that package. And I appreciated it just as much as what I did take away from the Crimson Peak features that I did see. So, great release. Anyway, we should probably wrap up here. But, you know, I think we would say these are both worth your time. Absolutely both worth picking up. And I want to thank you, Steph, for picking these because I probably wouldn't have covered either of them on the show necessarily. Not that I didn't like them and want to own them, but it was just not necessarily something that I was thinking about for the show specifically. So I'm glad that because of this, I dove into both of these. And it's one of the reasons I love doing this show is that, you know, you get to take a little film class with some of these features, and I never really get tired of it. Like you say, that's the thing that drives the obsession ultimately, you know?
I'm glad to hear it.
All right. Well, thank you, Steph, again, for coming on. Always appreciated. Always wonderful.
Yeah, I always have a great time. Just thinking about how we did episodes on Rappin' and Rockula. Like, can we just do an Elaine May?
Yeah, I mean, it's great.
I love those, but yeah.
No, I mean, those are fun, but I like this sort of new direction, you know, the gun crazy, Wild at Hearts, that kind of thing, you know, those are, you know, I think you can tell we're a little bit more passionate about those movies. Not that we aren't passionate about Rappin'. I mean, come on. If you've seen Rappin', you know that it's hard not to be passionate about that movie for what it is. But I do appreciate, you know, taking on stuff like this. It's quite nice. So thanks to Steph. And everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray-filled week. And we will talk to you very soon. So bye-bye.